1700.
Today we have Irving Eisenberg, CPA, PFS from the Wealth Manager Group and Royal Alliance, member, FINRA, SIPC. All investments involve risk and past performance cannot guarantee future results.
So happy it's Thursday. Welcome, ESPN 1700 AM. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
Big Mac David McKelvin,
and myself, Ryan White. Happy to be back on Thursday. Did a few extra Monday episodes. It was a lot of work.
Yeah, it was a lot more work than we wanted, right?
A lot more work. That's right. In studio with us today, Irving Eisenberg. He goes by Irv. Hi there, Irv. He is a wealth manager, CPA, website, wealthmgr.com, Chief Executive Officer of Wealth Manager Group here in San Diego. Thanks for joining us, Irv.
Thank you very much for having me.
Also, Kelly Mayer, CPA and JD with Mayer Tax Management. She's been practicing for more than 30 years. She's a great CPA here. She calls herself a spectacular handholder. We are happy to have Kelly with us in studio. Kelly, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show, Ryan.
You got it. Ahead of us today, we are going to talk about the impact of rising interest rates and what they will have on bonds. And I'm told it's a shocking answer. Can't wait to hear about that. Strategic versus tactical allocation and what it is. It's a strategy and which strategy Irv prefers and implements. And if we have time, we'll talk about the new tax act and how it's going to impact your wallet. And Kelly's going to talk to us about the fiscal cliff and some new tax planning opportunities all ahead of us in the next hour, as well as Tiffany Hazelar with Dedicated Credit Repair is going to do a small segment on what exactly happens when a consumer's credit is pulled. There's a lot of myths surrounding that, so she's going to talk to us right after the first break.
Yeah, big myth behind that. People think that if you pull it more than six times, it's going to start affecting your credit. That may be true, may not be true.
We'll find out. I don't honestly know. We will find out. Okay, Irv, you ready for this?
Sure am.
Okay. I guess bonds, investors traditionally look at bonds for income and to stabilize performance of their portfolio against the risk of the volatility of the stock market. How do we see rising interest rates to be changing this?
Well, rising interest rates, Ryan, could be deadly. You've heard about the bond bubble. You don't want the bond bubble to burst. Rising interest rates make the bonds that you presently own less valuable because if they go up, you're able to get new bonds that pay a higher interest rate that are far more attractive than the bonds you own. If you own individual bonds as an investor, you could always hold your bonds until maturity. The problem comes if you invest in bond mutual funds. The fund manager may be forced to sell bonds at a loss in the event that other shareholders in the fund elect to sell their investments. As a result, you could be interested in hanging on to your investment, but your bonds go down in value and your fund goes down in value.
So when you're talking about interest rates, obviously we're in the real estate world. We're talking about mortgages and interest rates associated with those, which have crept up about 0.25% so far this year. What is this interest rate you're talking about?
The rate I'm talking about is the rate that people borrow at or companies borrow at, the general interest rate. The Federal Reserve Bank has established a fixed rate and said they're not going to raise the rate until 2015. However, supply and demand for money could put us in a situation where the interest rates at which the consumer borrows actually go up, just as you've stated, mortgage interest rates have gone up.
So you're talking about the rate the Fed would charge is the interest rate you're mostly referring to.
That has a significant bearing on the way banks borrow as well as the rate we pay as investors. So if the rates on new bonds go up, our bonds become less valuable. And when the when the fund manager sells, the only way you could protect yourself is to sell your interest in the fund at a loss and reinvest the proceeds.
Probably pay a penalty, right? But if the gain is better than the penalty, you're going to make that move.
Well, you never know what you'll be able to reinvest in and whether it will outperform the bond fund if you just hang on to the bond fund and wait for the values of the fund to recover. So you have a choice, but it's not the same as owning your own bonds and just holding them to maturity. The real problem is bonds are your most conservative investment. Right. You rely on it for stability. So we're in a position similar to 2008, where do you hide? If the bonds are potentially going to go down in value, your most conservative investments, where do you go? They're different bond investments that have interest rate protection at the expense of some additional credit risk. That's what we're looking at for our clients that wish to stay in fixed income. We're rotating into other bond areas as well as looking at subtly increasing our equity positions for our portfolios.
Well, now, mortgage interest rates, and of course this is home mortgage interest rates, which do have some correlation to the interest rate you're talking about, federal interest rate, they have crept up slightly, but I tend to agree. I think it's kind of a given to some degree that they're going to stay low for the next year and a half or so.
Like Irv said, I mean, the government came out and said they're going to keep them low till 2015.
But do you trust the government?
Well, let's assume for a moment that they're about as low as they're going to go.
They're not going to go down. They're definitely going to go up. And there are some schools of thought that suggest that banks are unwilling to lend and make it difficult for borrowers to get money just because they don't want to lend at these low rates and they're waiting for rates to come up. There's a school of thought that says that the economy is actually being held back by the low interest rates.
Interesting, the politics behind interest rates and the rate that's being charged. You know, very good point. I mean, banks may be sitting back and saying, hey, you know, we want to loan the money that we have in our portfolio at a higher rate of return. Then, you know, why wouldn't they just borrow the money from the government at the lower payment and give these more restricted underwriting guideline loans right now and not necessarily open up their portfolio, which if they open up a portfolio type of loan, which we're starting to see a little bit more of that.
More. It's not prevalent, but more. Yeah.
And the government doesn't have any more money. Remember, we're in a huge deficit.
But we have lots of green ink.
Green ink, yes.
Yes, we have lots of green ink. Right.
Surplus of that. So with the understanding that interest rates can really only go one direction, although maybe we believe they're going to be not moving for 2 years, after the end of 2 years, they're certainly going to move. Should people be getting out of their bonds now? What's your suggestion on that?
Our suggestion is to rotate into bonds, that a different type of fixed income investment that protects you against rising interest rates. An example is floating rate senior securities. These are bank loans to corporations. They're not necessarily investment grade securities, so there's a little bit additional credit risk, but they're short-term bank loans for up to 2 years that renew at the end of that period. When the bank loan renews, if interest rates are higher, the bank can then renew the loan at a higher interest rate to the borrower. What that does is protect you as an investor against rising interest rates because you're not locked in at the really low rate for a prolonged period of time. The problem with the bond investments is when there's very little additional return and you're locked in for a longer period of time, anywhere from 5 to 7 years at a low rate, you face a big discount if you wish to sell the bond. So you're much better off with either floating rate things that adjust for interest, or the other investment category is higher yield bonds, so-called junk bonds. Investing in a fund spreads the credit risk among a wide variety of companies rather than actually owning one or two bonds. The credit risk is spread over a number of companies, and there's a bigger spread with the interest rate that they pay over the Treasury. So if Treasury rates come up, you're still getting paid a premium for that additional risk.
We're on with Irving Eisenberg. He is with Wealth Manager Group here in San Diego. Irving Eisenberg discussing some strategies to avoid a potentially increasing interest rate market. Sounds like you have some good strategies out there. The helpline, 888-551-2593. That's the number, 888-551-2593. Or his website, wealthmgr.com. That's the website, wealthmgr.com. When we come back, we are going to talk briefly about strategic versus tactical asset allocation. Tiffany Hazelar, Dedicated Credit Repair, is going to speak to us about the really the effect of what happens when a consumer's credit is pulled. And Kelly Mayer here is going to talk about the new fiscal cliff impact. All ahead of us when we come back. It's Thursday. Welcome, ESPN 1700. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
Big Mac David McKelvin.
And myself, Ryan White. In studio, Irving Eisenberg with Wealth Manager Group, LLC, and Kelly Mayer, Mayer Tax Management. Folks, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Also on the line, Tiffany Hazelar, Dedicated Credit Repair. Tiffany is going to enlighten us about, well, I guess maybe the myths about what happens when a consumer gets their credit
pulled. This is a good one.
Tiffany, tell us what's going on.
Hi guys. Thanks for having me back.
Hey there. How are you?
Love being on the show. Okay, so the first question we always get is how much the inquiries affect a FICO score. And FICO publishes basic information stating that about 10% of the cumulative score is indicated that inquiries would affect up to that much. So essentially, a consumer can lose about 3 to 5 points every time they have their credit pulled from an outside resource.
Wow. Well, 3 to 5 points after six, right? Or is there no minimum?
No, it's definitely 3 to 5 points. There's no minimum. Typically, though, we have heard a lot of misconceptions out there that people think that a consumer can pull credit multiple times if they're, for example, shopping for a home loan or maybe a car loan. And in essence, it's supposed to be that that would actually count only as one inquiry. But our resources at FICO tell us that depending on the actual pull source, it can actually be, even though there will be a short flurry or quick flurry of inquiries, it actually affects the score each time unless the consumer's lucky enough to go to the same pull source each time they have their credit pulled.
So just to reiterate, I think what you're saying is in most cases, every time someone has their credit pulled, they're going to get hit with some kind of point reduction.
Exactly. So the only two exceptions to that rule would be if a consumer went to any consumer website and pulled their own credit and purchased their own score, then that, of course, is a soft inquiry. And then in addition to that, the exception would be a current creditor that a consumer already does business with when they pull credit quarterly to see how the consumer's doing with financial risk. Then that, too, would also be considered a soft inquiry with no penalty.
Now, Tiffany, it's my understanding that the reason why this is in place is because the FICO score is a way of gauging the ability for a borrower to pay back that loan or something that may have been discovered by a previous lender that did some research and decided not to give that person a loan. Therefore, they're searching other resources. And so if you inquire a number of times with different resources, it's possibly an indication that you're kind of at your risk because they've discovered something that they don't share with each other, and the FICO score, the number of times you've inquired, may be an indication that there's something risky here. Is that why they do that?
Well, essentially, yes and no. Every single factor that determines the FICO score goes into an algorithm, and those algorithms are nothing more than the way that they determine risk factors, mathematical risk factors. So as a consumer shops for home loans or car loans, what they're telling FICO is that they're on the prowl for credit. And if there's a flurry of those, then they're going to wonder, why does the consumer want to obtain credit? So everything that you do indicates some level of risk. And, of course, obtaining new credit shows a concern for maybe excessive credit obtaining, or if the person's trying to max out their credit cards or find, you know, six different types of credit risk at the same time, then, of course, that would be an issue for FICO to be aware of.
I can see that. It certainly does make sense. And so maybe one option is getting your credit report from the first person and physically taking it to the other should you decide you're shopping it. Maybe that's a way of preventing it from continually being hit.
Absolutely. And then I always recommend that consumers go directly to myfico.com and purchase the score and then bring it to the auto dealership or sit down with your lender and have them run scenarios based on the actual information that you already have in hand, rather than allowing them to just, be curious and run your credit just to see how things are going.
That is a great way to do it.
That makes sense. That's Tiffany Hazelar, Dedicated Credit Repair. Tiffany is giving away free enrollment in Dedicated Credit Repair's Easy Pay Credit Repair Program, the helpline, 888-551-2593. That's the number, 888-551-2593. Tiffany, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Kelly Mayer from Mayer Tax Management is here to enlighten us on some of the current statuses that we're seeing with this fiscal cliff. Kelly, tell us a little bit about that. What's that all about?
Well, first of all, I think we need to understand exactly what the fiscal cliff is and was. Basically, it was a sharp decline in the federal budget deficit that could have occurred early this January due to increased taxes and reduced spending based on previously enacted tax laws. And as usual, our government at 2 o'clock in the morning passed a compromise bill, which was the American Tax Relief Act of 2012, which basically eliminated the revenue side of the fiscal cliff by implementing a higher deficit and a smaller increase. So we're kind of left with more of the same that we've had in the previous years. They basically just extended a lot of the credits and whatnot that we had, and there were a few key changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I noticed you brought in your book here of all the changes from 2012 to 2013.
Substantial book.
Yeah, it looks like a phone book. In fact, it's got all kinds of markings in it and highlights in it because there's just so many changes that are taking place. It's mayhem out there.
Yeah, you know, each year I tell everyone we usually feels like we're unzipping our head and dumping everything out and then dumping it all back in and trying to look things up as we go pretty much here.
Well, that's why you're around. You're the CPA here. I personally recommend Kelly. I use Kelly as my CPA, so it's an honor to have you on the show. And, you know, I tell you, when we're talking about all these changes, it seems as though that we've been given this opportunity because they've extended a lot of the allowed tax deductions that were put in place years ago. And are you of the opinion that this is going to be continued to be extended, or is there a sense of urgency going on right now in terms of getting things done while we still have this opportunity?
Well, certainly there's a sense of urgency going on right now. It seems the last few years we've been to the ninth hour just trying to figure out what it is we were going to do. You know, actually this year we don't even have tax forms ready for the IRS yet because we're still waiting for the computer people to implement the changes so we can e-file.
Wait, what do you mean you don't have the forms yet?
We're missing a lot of our forms. When we input our tax returns, we're getting diagnostics that say this form isn't ready. The IRS hopes to have them ready by the end of March.
The tax code changed.
And at the last minute.
At the last minute. Mm-hmm. And they don't have the forms available for you to prepare taxes.
Correct. So it's really bogging us down.
Quite a problem.
Yes, it is.
I know you CPAs love your form numbers, so that's an important thing. When do you suspect they will have them?
Well, last notice was that we should have them sometime mid-March. And
it's
there are a lot of forms that are ready, but quite
so
a few,
give
mostly
you 30
the credits.
Days.
Yeah, 30 days.
Mostly 30
days
the
with
credits
the forms.
Are not available.
The credits are not.
Yeah,
the credits are not.
Do they have the extension forms in place?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
and the pay now forms are
right. Those are that form hasn't changed.
That's right. The pay now forms. Fantastic. Well, we led off with the fiscal cliff, you know, talking about what's going on with the government. What the government has done in order to resolve it through the tax legislation in order and other measures to date. So tell us more about that.
Well, basically, tomorrow we're looking at this whole sequestration thing that has come down now. And basically, it's in old English law, it was a seizure of property for creditors. But basically, it's a fancy term for mandatory cuts to federal spending and federal programs. And this is supposed to happen tomorrow. So we'll really have to wait and see what's going to happen. We're estimated to cut $1.2 trillion in the next 10 years off the federal deficit, and $85 billion of that is supposed to happen in 2013. So it's going to be a wild ride. We're all going to have to kind of sit back and just wait and see what happens.
So with these cutbacks, are you expecting a lot of layoffs with that, or what's happening?
They're estimating that there's going to be 750,000 to 800,000 layoffs if this does go through.
Wow.
Tomorrow.
Okay, so, you know, we also briefly talked about how do you feel about the overall impact to taxpayers with the new American Tax Relief Act of 2012. And the reason why we're talking about 2012 is obviously when you're filing your return now, you're filing your return in the rear. So we're talking about 2012 returns.
Right. Well, I think a lot of the credits, like I said, have been extended for middle-income America. The folks that are getting hit the hardest are the high-income earners. We've got an additional 0.9 Medicare surtax on earned income, which does kick in this year. For singles and head of household, it's $200,000, married filing joint, $250,000, and married filing separate, $125,000. So this is your wages and your self-employment income. And it applies only to the employee's share of the Medicare tax. So the employers don't have to pay it, but the employees or the employers will withhold the surtax once an employee's wages exceed that $200,000 mark. And then we'll have to deal with that at the tax return side when the clients come in to prepare their 1040s. Another part of the Medicare surtax, is on net investment income. It begins this year, and it's kind of a convoluted formula, but basically the surtax is levied on the smaller of the filer's net investment income or the excess of modified AGI over the applicable dollar threshold. So, and that's the same AGI limitation, single and head of household. It's $200,000, married filing joint over $250,000, and married filing separate over $125,000 apiece.
Well, I tell you, you know, one of the things we led with was talking about how you're hand-holding a lot of your clients, right? So really, I think when you say that, what you mean is that there's just an overwhelming number of changes. And for a lot of folks out there, the filing your tax return is an overwhelming process. There's just so many things that need to get together.
Correct.
So what you're really doing is you're saying, stop, let's take this one step at a time. We're going to get this done together. And that's you're not looking for every single client out there. You're looking for just a handful of quality people that you work with, and you really take them by the hand and help them through this process.
Yes, and I think anymore it's critical to do tax planning. You know, with all these changes and stuff, it's very difficult. You know, I have clients call in and ask me, can you tell me the answer to this? And it's almost like, you know, you're in law school. It's like, well, it depends. And you really need to get a big picture of the client's portfolio and what their goals and objectives are to be able to see what we can do and some different ways we can maneuver around and do some tax planning.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Kelly Mayer of Mayer Tax Management in Carlsbad, California. Direct line to her is 619-993-4495. That's her number. Direct 619-993-4495.
When we come back, we're going to talk more with Irv Eisenberg, and we're going to discuss which of the two most popular portfolio asset allocation strategies he prefers and why, strategic or tactical, all ahead of us when we come back. Welcome back. So happy it's Thursday. ESPN 1700 AM. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
Big Mac David McKelvin.
And myself, Ryan White. In studio with us today, Irv Eisenberg, Wealth Manager Group, LLC. He is the Chief Executive Officer, CEO.
That's right.
Thank you for joining us. Also, Kelly Mayer, Mayer Tax Management, CPA, and JD. Kelly, again, thank you for being with us.
Thanks.
All right, Irv, we talked, we foreshadowed two popular personal portfolio asset allocation strategies, strategic versus tactical. Tell us what the difference is and which one you employ.
Strategic versus tactical. Which is the best? Well, in my opinion, I use tactical allocation. I think in today's environment, flexibility to adapt to changing economic conditions, changing personal conditions, etc., flexibility is just critical. Let me define the two for you. First, strategic allocation. You establish target allocations for the different asset classes in your portfolio. So let's say I was investing for Kelly, and I evaluated her risk, and she wanted a balanced portfolio, 60% stocks and 40% fixed income and cash. Perfect. We set up the portfolio, we invest in the different asset classes, and then periodically, no less than once a year, we rebalance because some things go up higher than others, and she wants to be at 60-40. We reset the positions at 60-40 with the idea we buy low on things that went down to increase those percentages up to 40 or so, or 60, and we sell high to recognize gains on things that went up during the year and artificially increased our allocation. So that's strategic allocation, and you don't make any changes. The advantage to this is it protects you against the emotion affecting your portfolio in an adverse fashion. You buy, you hold, you sit there, and you let the market do its thing. Now, tactical is different. You have flexibility. So in 2008, when it was quite obvious that things were going to be problematic and the problems were going to become more severe, we reduced equity positions for many of our clients that had grown to as high as 80% down to 20 and 30%. We saved our clients millions of dollars. If we hadn't reacted, we would have been like a number of people who lost maybe as much as 40, 50% of their life savings due to lack of a response to what to me seemed like pretty obvious market conditions.
Yeah, there really are two different types of approaches here. We're talking fixed, in your words, strategic, and flexible, which is the tactical. And I really do see the difference where, you know, different financial planners will say, let's just pick a plan and let it ride. And if it goes down, don't sell because it's coming back up. Whereas you're saying that possibly a tactical approach, depending on evaluating the risk, which I think was one of the key things you touched on, was evaluating the risk of your client and then deciding which tactical allocation, strategic or tactical, you'll take.
We are on with Irving Eisenberg. He's the CEO of Wealth Manager Group, LLC, discussing the difference between strategic and tactical personal portfolio asset allocation strategies. He can be reached at his office, 619-574-7526, 619-574-7526, wealthmgr.com, or the helpline, 888-551-2593. That's the number, 888-551-2593. So before we leave this topic, just to be perfectly clear, tactical. That's where you're at. That is the asset allocation strategy you employ.
Tactical allocation is what we employ for the benefit of our clients. And to us, the key to the tactical allocation is rather than investing for the maximum return, our goal is to evaluate our clients' needs and objectives, identify what they are, and make sure that our strategy helps them accomplish those goals and objectives without unnecessary risk. If a client's goals and objectives are going to be achieved with a more modest rate of return, we could tone down the risk aspect of the portfolio, achieve their goals, and at the end of the day, they'll be fine. If we pursue an approach strictly based on return, we may run into adverse circumstances independent of what we do, but problems in the stock market or the economy.
Of course.
That can adversely affect them and preclude them from achieving their goals, which were readily attainable with a more conservative strategy.
Do you find that the general consumers out there are looking for one or the other in their wealth manager? Does a consumer know that there are two different approaches?
Typically, the client is looking to us for guidance. The typical client, at the end of the day, they are good at what they do. We have a number of very affluent clients that are outstanding at what they do. They don't do what we do. We work incredibly hard. I've done this type of work as a CPA and then as a financial advisor for 36 years. It's tough for someone to simulate our experience and what we do as far as education and planning, It's tough for an individual to do this on their own behind the scenes. They appreciate what we do and look to us for the guidance to direct them in a proper format to achieve their goals.
I guess what I mean to say is when someone with money to invest goes to a wealth manager, are they specifically looking for someone who employs a tactical asset allocation strategy or a strategic? Do people look for that in a wealth manager? Do people interview wealth managers and discern their investment strategy? Or is that something that you utilize to simply educate the consumer as the way it should be done?
They don't specifically look for an advisor that does one or the other. However, some people wish to be more proactive with changing their portfolio than others.
I would think so.
And lead us down that path. So while they may not look for someone that engages in strategic versus tactical, they're looking for a particular service that meets their needs, and their needs will typically lead you down a path of either regular tactical changes, more frequent tactical changes, or an approach that may actually resemble strategic allocation by making fewer changes over a period of time and letting the markets do what they do rather than just constantly engaging in tactics and making a lot of portfolio changes.
We're on with Irv Eisenberg, CEO of Wealth Manager Group, LLC, here in San Diego, the website wealthmgr.com. Just explain to us the difference between strategic asset allocation and tactical asset allocation and how they employ tactical asset allocation. Real quick, before we head to the break, we talked about the new Tax Act, and how is that going to impact the stock market? Is it stock market friendly?
The new Tax Act was definitely stock market friendly.
Oh.
First of all, we saw it at the end of the year. The stock market at the end of the year, when the new Tax Act went into effect, the fourth quarter U.S. stock market was actually down. As soon as the Tax Act was passed, we had a sudden jump in the stock market, and the first quarter has been very favorable to the stock market. Only 1% of Americans were really affected by tax increases. The lion's share of Americans have the vast majority of their money intact after the tax changes, other than the elimination of the Social Security tax reduction of 2%, which was a temporary thing, which costs everybody a little bit of money. Other than that, people were expecting a much more severe tax increase covering a wider group of people, and the market responded favorably to that starting in the first quarter.
That's great news. It really, really is. I frankly didn't expect you to have that opinion on it. That is wonderful news. When we come back, Kelly Mayer is going to talk to us more about AMT. What is AMT, Kelly?
AMT is the alternative minimum tax.
It's ahead of us when we come back.
Welcome back to ESPN 1700. We are live with Irving Eisenberg, CPA. Welcome.
Thank you.
Chief Executive Officer for Wealth Manager Group. And we have Kelly Mayer in the studio today, CPA JD. Kelly Mayer with Mayer Tax Management is here. Kelly, you know, we talked a little bit about the AMT, the Alternative Minimum Tax. In 1969, the government said, hey, there are people out there that are taking so many deductions that they're not even paying any taxes. And they, at the time, had put a price in mind of income. And they said if you made above X amount of money, which I think was between $100,000 and $150,000, that you had to pay some minimum tax. Well, that just rode till 1982, and they had to amend that because of the fact that people's income actually started exceeding that threshold. And now President Obama, with the American Tax Relief Act, has extended that as well. So, Kelly, are you a fan of the AMT?
Well, actually, it's a flat tax rate that's an add-on. And like you said, it originally started back in 69, and there was, believe it or not, 155 taxpayers that were in the high income, which was over 200,000 at the time, that did not pay any tax. So they decided to have this alternative minimum tax kick in, making it more fair for everyone so that everybody had to pay their fair share. And like you said, it's metamorphosized throughout the years. And then what has happened throughout the years is there was an exemption amount. And this exemption amount has stayed the same practically for the last 35 years. And so as people's income over the years have increased, it's basically made middle America subject to the alternative minimum tax. And basically the tax is, when we do your tax return, we calculate a regular tax. And we also calculate an alternative minimum tax. And the taxpayer pays the higher of the two. So that's basically what the alternative minimum tax is.
So in the end, good news, in the end, the government wins, right?
Exactly. The good news is that there's been a permanent AMT patch put into place with the new law, where there's an $80,750 exemption rather than the $35,000 or so that it was, and it's been indexed for inflation. So hopefully some taxpayers out there in middle America will see some relief.
Well, you know, speaking of relief, we touched a little bit about the individual exemptions of $5 million during their lifetime at death with the new laws that were passed. So what are you seeing? What opportunities are showing up with this $5 million lifetime or at death?
Well, the $5 million is actually an exclusion now for the estate tax. For most Americans, and it's basically going to eliminate a lot of the tax planning and that we'll need to do for most folks. The effect of the change is going to allow husband and wife to engage in income tax planning where they'll get a step up in basis on assets that are transferred to the next generation, not only at the first death but the second death as well. And basically what this does is it renders the credit shelter trust obsolete for most folks. Where we used to transfer some of that to kind of preserve it for the second to die.
So I have a question about that. Let's explain a little bit more. Your exemption of $5 million, what does that mean? What does that mean, you're exempt up to $5 million?
Well, when you die, depending on the value of your estate, $5 million is exempt from estate tax, which is at a very high rate.
So I can transfer up to $5 million to my heirs,
yes,
to anybody I want, without them paying any taxes on a value of up to $5 million.
Correct.
And has that number come down or gone up, or has it always been $5 million?
It's gone up, and it's gone back and forth so many times. I think Irv can – what has it ended up being?
It's gone up dramatically. It originally started at $600,000 and escalated from there. It went up to $5 million just this last year. Actually, it was $5,120,000. They made it a permanent part of the law. It relates to lifetime transfers during your lifetime or at death. You have the ability to transfer what is now in 2013 index for inflation, $5.25 million, or for a husband and wife, $10.5 million. If you have more than that at death, that isn't excluded, it's now subject to an increased tax at 40%.
40% seems pretty steep.
Yeah.
40% seems pretty steep. So, you know, Kelly, we talked a little bit about the Medicare surtax, and you had showed me, I guess, some information about five ways to derail this extra Medicare surtax.
Sure. There's some planning aspects that can be taken care of that could, you know, maybe move this around or shuffle it into another year. You could have increased participation in passive activities, there would not be income tax based on that, depending on your tax situation. You could add.
What do you mean by passive activities?
Passive activities are basically activities that you're passive with. Real estate is considered a passive activity unless you are actually in the real estate business.
Really passive?
No, not you guys would. I think you guys would be active in real estate because that is your main business. But for most folks that just have rental properties, that would be a passive activity.
So owning real estate and perhaps gathering rental income,
sure,
from it is a passive activity.
Yeah.
Got it.
Investments in limited partnerships where you're a limited partner, obviously. Things of this nature where you don't materially participate in them. There's some things about selling your home. You could think about selling your home, whereby there's a $500,000 exemption for married filing separate. I mean, sorry, married filing joint. So that would also be an exclusion that would get you out of the Medicare tax.
We're doing a neat thing for our clients. One of the other categories of exempt income is the municipal bond interest. So if people are going to be subject to the Medicare surtax, by reducing their taxable interest that would be subject to the surtax and reclassifying it, reinvesting it in municipal bonds, generates exempt interest from the surtax and protects them from the additional 3.8% tax.
Very nice, very nice. You know, I tell you, talking about extensions, the Mortgage Debt Relief Act was extended. There was some scare out there about that not actually being extended.
Yeah, that's certainly a good thing, I think, for the consumers out there. The Mortgage Debt Relief Act, and Kelly, I'm sure you can elaborate on this a little bit further, but it was to allow debt relief that is a short sale client is granted through the short sale process to not force them to have to pay taxes on that debt relief granted. Is that right?
Sure. Well, they've extended the cancellation of debt relief whereby it'll go through December 31st of 2013, and that cancellation of debt income ordinarily would be taxable to the taxpayer, and now they have extended that so that that would be excluded from their income.
So just so you know what we're talking about, let's just say that you owe $500,000 on a property. You short sell it for $300,000. The IRS sees that $200,000 relief from the bank, that they forego that $200,000 loan. That is seen as income to the IRS, and they were taxing people in the beginning of this process based on that $200,000 income that they really didn't receive.
Right, that's correct.
And now with the Mortgage Debt Relief Act that's in place for one more year, it's allowing people to go ahead and do these short sales and take advantage of that exemption and not have to pay taxes on what people would think would be quite ridiculous.
That's correct. And, you know, there was a rule, too, for other cancellation of debt type of items that would come onto a tax return where if you were insolvent immediately preceding the debt relief, that also was not taxable. That was one of the exclusions. But the government did come in and say that these taxpayers would not have to pay the additional tax.
And insolvency is still in the books. That
yes.
hasn't changed. That still is part of it. But Mortgage Debt Relief Protection Act being extended certainly is a good thing. We're on with Kelly Mayer with Mayer Tax Management talking about, well, AMT and now the Mortgage Debt Relief Protection Act. Kelly can be reached through the helpline at 888-551-2593. That's the number, 888-551-2593, or mayertaxmanagement.com, mayertaxmanagement.com, as well as Irv Eisenberg, CEO of Wealth Manager Group, LLC. He reached also at the helpline, 888-551-2593, or his website, wealthmgr.com. Folks, thank you both for joining us. We'll talk to you all next week.
Until next Thursday.